Approximately 11 million Americans suffer from an eating disorder. These diseases are hard to understand, difficult to treat, and too often deadly. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we'll talk about eating disorders. I'll talk with a survivor who nearly lost her life to anorexia nervosa, a mother and daughter in the midst of their battle with an eating disorder. I'll also talk with therapist Michelle Rawling, who is president of the Eating Disorder Coalition of Iowa, and Sue Clarahan, a registered dietitian in private practice in Iowa City. We also want to hear from you this hour. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're going to talk about eating disorders. Approximately 11 million Americans suffer from one. For those of us who don't, it's almost impossible to understand how and why a person would starve themselves. The diseases are dangerous, they're difficult to understand, they're very difficult to treat, and later this hour I'll talk with people who are helping to treat eating disorders. Therapist Michelle Rawling, she's also president of the Eating Disorder Coalition of Iowa, and Sue Clarahan, a registered dietitian in private practice in Iowa City. She's also on the board of the Eating Disorder Coalition. My first guest today is Alyssa Murphy, who lives in Des Moines. She's also my cousin by marriage, and she nearly lost her life to anorexia nervosa. She has agreed to tell us her story today. Hello, Alyssa.
Hi. Good morning, Charity.
Thank you so much for agreeing to share this story, Alyssa. I think it's important for people to understand what you've gone through, and I want to go back to when this started, when you were about 15 years old. What were some of the first behaviors that you can see now were warning signs of your disease?
For me, it started with exercise. And so whether it was soccer or going to the gym every day or running up and down the stairs in my house, just being constantly active.
And that doesn't seem like a negative thing, but where did that come from, do you think?
I'm not quite sure. I think it was just trying to burn calories that I was eating. And so the focus shifted from health to burning calories.
When did you start to change your diet?
Right around that same time. And so I started to restrict, actively restrict.
And your focus was on being thin?
My focus was on losing weight and being thin. But there was never a set weight goal.
When you first started doing this exercise and doing this restricting, what kind of a response did you get from people around you?
Initially, it was positive. My friends, not necessarily my family, but my friends were just very positive, and it was good, and I was doing a good thing, and it was, accepted.
A little while after this, you decided to move from your home with your mom and dad in with your grandma and grandpa. You were living in Colorado with your parents, then you moved to Kansas with your grandparents.
Yes.
Why did you make that move?
There were a lot of different reasons for that, but there was a lot of fighting within the home, not because of my parents, but because of me. I was being a typical teen and just wanting to rebel, and it just wasn't a good thing for any of us. And I made the choice to move in with my grandparents because I felt like it was something that I needed.
When you were living with your grandparents, these behaviors, these restrictive behaviors, got a lot worse. When did someone first confront you about the possibility that you had an eating disorder?
I was dealing with a lot of stomach pain at the time, probably when I was about 16 or 17, I was dealing with a lot of stomach pain. And my grandma had taken me to a family doctor that was close to where they lived in Kansas City. And he was the one who initially said, you might have an eating disorder. And I can remember sitting in his office, just curled up in a ball in the corner of his, just saying, no, I don't have a problem. You don't know what you're talking about. I don't need any help.
Where did things go from there?
He he had put me on some, I think, acid reduction medication or something like that, but things continued to get worse, and I ended up in the emergency room one night when my potassium had bottomed out. I wasn't feeling well, I was very dizzy, and it was to the point where they say you KO your potassium, where it was just so low that it was dangerous. And so they had hooked me up to IVs, and then they had put me on, my first hospitalization was in a general psych unit. It was not on an eating disorder specialized floor.
You say your first hospital visit. There were many hospital visits after that, weren't there?
Many, yes.
Did you ever choose to go to the hospital yourself?
No. It was never, I want to go to the hospital to get better. That never came out of my mouth. It was always either from a family member or a doctor or somebody. I was only legally committed to go to the hospital once, but every time it was not of my choosing.
How long did it take you to admit that you had an eating disorder?
Several hospital visits later. Years. It took years. And even after I recognized that I had an issue, it took years to be able to work on the issue. I could recognize that I had a problem, but I still didn't want to work on it.
You didn't want to get better?
No.
Why not?
Because it was mine. It was my safety. It was my illusion of safety. It was my control. I felt like I had control, even though I was completely out of control. It wasn't anything that somebody could take from me.
When you were in the hospital, and again, there were many different hospitalizations, you then moved to Iowa with your parents and stayed in hospitals here and in Iowa City. During those hospitalizations, especially at times when you were in a wing that was specifically dedicated to people with eating disorders, what was the culture like among the other young women who you were hospitalized with?
It was very difficult. There was a sense of friendship and sisterhood and camaraderie, but there was also an underlying and sometimes very obvious sense of competitiveness and jealousy and, learning from each other ways to get away with things.
So there was even a desire to be the best anorexic in the wing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And who came in at the lowest weight? Who was the skinniest? Who could hide the most food so they didn't have to eat it? Who could exercise in the room without being caught?
Alyssa, what did it take for you to finally realize that you wanted to get better?
So there was one morning when I was living with my parents, and they had a scale in a different room, and they were having me weigh myself on a regular basis, but I would tell them, I wouldn't necessarily have them go in with me to watch me weigh myself. And this morning, my father had gone in with me, and he had seen the number on the scale, and I could tell on his face that he was just terrified. So he told me we were going to the hospital that day. He didn't care which hospital it was. He didn't care whether it was Iowa City or not. And I was just so exhausted by that point, I was done fighting him. And so I was getting ready and getting some things packed in my room, and this wave of exhaustion just fell over me, and I fell into the bed. And my dad called out to me at some point and asked me how things were going, and I opened my mouth to talk, and no words could come out of my mouth. I was just too weak to even say anything.
You were too weak to get up. You were too weak to talk.
Yep. And so my dad picked me up and carried me to the van, and we drove into Mary Greeley in Ames. And at the ER, they hooked me up to some IVs. I was under about 20 of those magnificently warmed blankets. And the doctor in the ER had told my parents that if they had brought me in about an hour later, I would have been dead.
So what was different that time? I mean, clearly you had a near-death experience, but you had been so sick for so long. What changed that day for you?
I think just the realization, I mean, physically experiencing that my body was shutting down. My dad has always told me, you know, you don't know what damage you've done to your body. Even to this day, you don't know internally what's wrong, what's been wrong, what you could have done. And just sensing, feeling the energy drain out of me and not being able to talk. That was the first time that I had gotten so weak that I couldn't even talk. That really woke me up, I think.
Since that time, what has your struggle been like? I mean, you found the will to live, you found the will to get better, but it hasn't been an easy path.
No, it's a daily struggle. I mean, I still deal with a distorted body image. I think I will always deal with a distorted body image. And I will always have a very careful relationship with food.
You told me once that you have to think about food as medicine.
Yes.
And you still have to do that even today, years later?
Oh, yes. Yes.
You have a son now who is 2 years old. And, of course, many people who experience the kind of eating disorder struggle that you experienced are never able to have children. That's one of the very common side effects. When you discovered you were pregnant, what did you think?
I was amazed. I mean, Killian is my miracle baby. I wasn't sure that I could have children. And I was terrified because I knew what pregnancy came with. And experiencing that was very difficult.
So watching your body grow was really hard for you?
It was very difficult. I constantly went back and forth between feeling guilty for not wanting to gain weight and trying to fight it versus knowing that I needed to do that for the baby inside of me and knowing that the only way that he was going to get the nutrition that he needed was through me eating.
In some ways, did that experience make your daily struggle easier? Did having a baby and being a mother make it easier to fight this every day?
It does, yes. Yes, he helps me fight my demons, for sure.
A doctor once told your parents that you would be dead by the time you were 30 years old. You passed that milestone. You are 30. You are a successful woman. You are a mother. Do you ever pause and think about that?
No. Yes. I mean, yes and no. I guess because it's the way that my life has happened. You know, maybe if I had experienced life in a different way, I wouldn't know what that was like. But this is all I know.
Well, your entire family is very proud of you and loves you very much, Alyssa. Thank you so much for telling us your story today.
Thank you.
Alyssa Murphy of Des Moines. Again, she is my cousin by marriage, and she agreed to tell her story to us today. In just a moment, I'll also talk with a mother and daughter who are still engaged in the battle with an eating disorder. I'll talk with a therapist who works with people with eating disorders and also a dietitian coming up in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we're talking about eating disorders. Eating disorders are diseases that affect approximately 11 million Americans, mostly women, but many men also suffer from eating disorders as well. In a few minutes, I'll be talking to a couple of people who work hard to help treat eating disorders. Michelle Rowling is a therapist, and she's also co-founder and president of the Eating Disorder Coalition of Iowa. She'll be here in a moment, along with Sue Clarahan, a registered dietitian. But first, I want to welcome Molly Hebert to the show. She's a student at Des Moines Area Community College, and she lives in Ankeny. Hello, Molly.
Hi.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
And you also brought your mom with you as well, Mary Hebert. Hello, Mary.
Hello.
Thank you for being here today.
Thank you.
And Molly, how old are you now?
I am 20 years old.
You're 20 years old, and you have been struggling with an eating disorder since you were 15. How did this start for you?
It started as a diet and then just escalated into more.
And Mary, as Molly was beginning to experience this problem, this wasn't something that was easy for you to see, was it? How long did it take for you to realize there was something going on?
We actually didn't realize that Molly had an eating disorder until she was a senior in high school.
So for about 3 years.
Right.
Molly, can you tell me a little bit about where you think this came from and why it became an important part of you?
I think I always had eating behaviors, even before I was 15. It's just something I started doing to cope when I was sad, whether I was angry. And it really took off when I was 15. And I think I really latched on to my anorexic behaviors. And it just took from there. And then I saw something I could control. I wanted control.
We hear that a lot in stories about eating disorders, that this is something that gives you complete control. We also hear people talk about it as an addictive behavior. For you, it seems that it was an addictive behavior. What is the feeling that kept you on this path, that kept you, you've been through both anorexia and bulimia, as many people with eating disorders have experienced different manifestations of an eating disorder. What was the feeling that was your reward for this behavior?
It wasn't so much a feeling, it was the lack of feeling. I would feel numb when I was doing my behaviors. I am someone that is more comfortable not feeling feelings than feeling happy or feeling sad. I really don't prefer to feel feelings. So I would feel numb doing a behavior, and I was okay with that. I would be like, if I purged, I would purge the feeling of how much I hated myself. If I starved, I would starve until I was numb about how much I hated my life.
What did it take for you to realize you had a problem?
I think I was the last one to realize. Everyone knew except me.
Mary, were you involved in helping Molly understand that she had a problem?
Actually, we had an incident at the end of September of her senior year, one weekend, and she was put in to a psych hospital. And from there, just going to the therapists, and we got hooked up with a dietitian, and then finally got in with Michelle. So it wasn't something that even I knew until that weekend. You know, I knew she was dieting. I knew that she was exercising. I just didn't realize to what extent both were.
The symptoms of eating disorders are very easy to miss, and we'll talk about that more as the hour goes on. When you came to understand that your daughter had been struggling with this for 3 years, I'm sure in retrospect you could begin to see the signs, but
right.
What went through your head when you realized this had been going on for so long and you didn't know?
Scared and guilty that she had been going through all these things and we didn't realize it. Molly and I are fairly close. We're pretty close. And you know, I think even as time goes on, I still realize the things that, how much terror and scary things that she went through that I had no idea. And I feel guilty for that.
For those of us who don't have eating disorders, it's very difficult to understand what a person with an eating disorder is going through. How do you try to understand your daughter?
Knowledge. Learning about eating disorders when she's gone to treatment. Most of the time I end up going and they have family days where they teach us about eating disorders. So the best way I can help Molly is by learning about the eating disorders myself.
Molly, you are 20 years old now. Is this something you still struggle with every day?
Yes, and I do think I will continue to struggle with it the rest of my life. But I do know that it will get easier as time goes on. Just because my ED is still in my head now, 20 years from now, hopefully, it will be a lot quieter. It will become a whisper instead of what it is right now, which is like a baby screaming in my head right now.
Are there specific things as you look around the world, as you experience the world, as you go to school, that seem to trigger this screaming in your head?
Yes. A lot of things can trigger me, but you can't live in a box or in a house all day. Like, when I go to treatment, it's a very nice place to live because they do a trigger-free environment. But when you come out and start living again, it's like you almost want to go back because it's very hard living out here in the world through the media, through what people say. A lot of people don't realize a comment can really trigger you, whether that's you look really good or, one comment that really bugs me when I leave treatment is that, Molly, you look so healthy. You know, you think that would be a positive comment. For me, it's really not. And I've heard many people that have eating disorders say, that's not helpful to them either. And really understanding and learning about eating disorders, if you know someone that has an eating disorder and want to help, is going to be really beneficial to your guys' relationship and realizing what is the right thing to say and what is not.
What does help?
Listening, reading about the eating disorder or going to the family days and treatment, not always giving advice to them, just listening. And don't be the food police. Absolutely do not be the food police. They have a treatment team for that, a dietitian. Don't tell them that they should eat this or that amount or whatever amount. When people try to food police me, I rebel. And I'm not saying everyone will rebel, but they're probably going to be mad at you.
And that could be one of those triggers.
Yes.
How are you feeling about the future right now? I know that you've had a bumpy road trying to start your higher education, but you're back in school right now. How does the future look to you?
Hopeful. I have had a really rocky recovery. Hasn't been so smooth, but I'm in a place right now where I can see a future for myself that isn't full of treatment centers anymore.
Well, Molly, thank you so much for sharing your story with us today.
Thank you.
Molly Hebert is a student at Des Moines Area Community College. She's been struggling with an eating disorder since she was 15 years old. And Mary Hebert, thank you so much.
Thank you. I did want to say one thing. The EDCI does have, it's called Coffee Connection, that we've started for parents with children with eating disorders. You can look for it on our website. But it's the second Sunday of the month at Cafe DM in Ankeny from 4 to 6.
All right. And has that been helpful to you to connect with other parents who are seeing their children go through this?
It's very helpful to connect with other parents because eating disorders are very isolating. They're isolating for the children and they can be isolating for the caregivers too.
Well, thanks again so much for being here today, Mary.
Thank you.
Mary Hebert is Molly Hebert's mother, and of course she's been involved in this struggle with her daughter. We're talking about eating disorders today on Talk of Iowa, and with me now is Michelle Rowling. She is co-founder and president of the Eating Disorder Coalition. She is also a therapist and clinical care coordinator at Iowa State University Student Counseling Services. She has a private practice in Adel called Sharing is Healing. Michelle, thanks for coming back to the show.
Absolutely. Thanks for having us all on this morning, Charity.
Sue Clarahan is also here. She is a registered dietitian who has a private practice in Iowa City. She's also a board member for the Eating Disorder Coalition of Iowa. Hello, Sue.
Hi, Charity.
Thank you for being here today. And Michelle, I want to start with, we were just listening to Molly and Mary talk about how this struggle had been going on for 3 years before anyone could help Molly, before anybody really realized what was going on. What are some of the signs, some of the early warning signs for parents? And of course, this doesn't just happen to kids. This happens to people of all ages. So for parents, for partners, for friends, what kinds of things do you see?
Well, absolutely. There are some commonalities amongst people. And the big thing that I really want to point out is that it's not about someone's size. So you can't look at someone and know the status of their health. Eating disorders are about all kinds of things that don't include your weight. So we notice changes in personality. We notice isolation. We notice big mood swings. We might notice secrecy and the start of lying about random things that don't make sense to families. There may be food that disappears or eating in private, or you may start to notice food being thrown away. So a lot of personality changes that happen along the way.
I can imagine, especially when this is happening with a teenager, parents just putting that down to being a teenager.
Yes, especially when it's happening right at that adolescent age. And so really it takes, you know, talking and listening to your loved one and finding out how are they doing and what's really going on for them.
It also sounds like other than the food-related issues, a lot of those symptoms can be signs of something else going wrong as well.
Eating disorders are really about trying to cope with something else. It just happens that for these individuals that they turn to control through food or numbing through food versus maybe alcohol or some other form of negative coping. And so the eating disorder is the symptom of whatever is really going on. Now, of course, the eating disorder is an incredible and very serious situation. But in order to recover from an eating disorder, we do have to figure out what is the real core issue that's going on.
We have a number of people on the phone right now who want to share their stories. And so I want to talk to one of those people before we get to a break. And then we'll continue this conversation about diagnosing and treatment and also, of course, trying to reintroduce food and regain a healthy relationship with food, maybe for the first time. Kelly is on the line now from Riverside. Hi, Kelly.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thank you for calling us. And you also suffered from an eating disorder for many years, right?
I did. I started purging when I was 15, and bulimia ended up being my supposed friend for about 12 years before I finally was able to go to treatment and overcome a lot of my behaviors. So it was a very long
road. For 12 years, you went without treatment at all?
Yeah, I was in and out of a few counselors, but I never, after college, was a really good transitional time for me to go to treatment, but I didn't really have the emotional and financial support to go, and so I wasn't able to go. And so 4 years later, still suffering, got married, bought a house, did all those grown-up things, but I still was definitely struggling very badly, and found out I was pregnant, and that was kind of a turning point for me.
Through that time, did you keep this a secret from your husband and from the people who were close to you?
Sure. My husband, actually, I met him after college, and he was always just really supportive and understanding. He's a chef, so cooking and trying to be healthy and those sorts of things were a positive influence, trying to meal plan, that sort of stuff, which is beneficial. That was very helpful. I tried to have open communication with my family. Everybody that's spoken so far has talked about that education is just really important for being a good support system. And so when I went through treatment, it was mostly just my husband supporting me, which was unfortunate, but it was also just a really special time for the two of us getting closer as I was expecting a baby. So,
And so for you, it was your pregnancy that finally gave you a reason to get better?
I think so. I suffered with hyperemesis gravidarium, which is severe morning sickness. And so that was very confusing. The thing is that in general, I think eating disorders, especially during pregnancy, are grossly underdiagnosed. Our screening processes aren't strong enough. And I think I got the care that I needed because I was upfront from the very beginning that I had an active eating disorder. And I think less than half of the people with eating disorders going through pregnancy tell their care providers, which is just unfortunate. Doesn't surprise me.
Right. Well, Kelly, I want you to stay with us. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We want to hear more of your story in a moment. This hour, we're talking about eating disorders on Talk of Iowa, and we'd love for you to join the conversation at 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about eating disorders on Talk of Iowa. And the Eating Disorder Coalition of Iowa is having an awareness day coming up on Saturday, February 22nd from 8 to 4 p.m. at DMAX Southridge Center in Des Moines. Also, National Eating Disorders Awareness Week is coming up February 24th through March 2nd. There will be many events around the state, including in Iowa City, a screening of the movie Someday Melissa at the Pomerantz Center. That'll be on Monday, February 24th. And this hour, we're hearing a lot of personal stories about eating disorders. Also with me is Michelle Rowling. She is co-founder and president of the Eating Disorder Coalition of Iowa and a therapist. And Sue Clarahan, registered dietitian who has a private practice in Iowa City. She's also a board member for the Eating Disorder Coalition of Iowa and the Association for Size, Diversity, and Health. And with us on the phone right now is Kelly from
Hi.
Riverside, and we had to interrupt you as you were telling your story.
And
you were talking about how underdiagnosed you believe eating disorders are among pregnant women, which sounds very frightening. For you, when you were pregnant, as you mentioned, you had severe morning sickness. So in addition to the eating disorder, the morning sickness must have made this incredibly difficult. How did you help yourself to have a healthy pregnancy, given all those barriers in your way?
Sure. I think it was going through the really bad morning sickness that was confusing that kind of led me to finally going to treatment. So I did a partial treatment where Monday through Friday, 8 to 5, I was in the hospital. And I didn't really have a lot of choice in it. I felt like that was my one shot, I mean, financially, and I had a baby coming. And so to go to treatment after the baby was born seemed really scary. So I felt like this was my shot to be healthy. So I kind of went into treatment with that attitude. And I think that really was helpful. Treatment helped me challenge my distorted thoughts and really kind of had me break the cycle of binge purge. Because even with pregnancy and still having morning sickness, that was very confusing. Would a normal pregnant woman who wasn't bulimic, would she be vomiting right now? And that was kind of the struggle that I went through. And so I think treatment for me was just incredibly necessary, especially since the relapse rate is so high for women with eating disorders in the postpartum period. So even if I had remission of symptoms throughout pregnancy, I think that just with the stress of a new baby and everything like that, that I would have just gone back to my behaviors. So I just felt like that was my time to finally get help.
How old is your baby now?
He is 2.5 and busy.
Nice. And how is your struggle every day?
Overall, I feel like my behaviors are much better. I think from the very beginning, I've been very forgiving of myself in the sense that if I mess up, it's not defining my path. that recovery is a journey. And so my behaviors are much better. I think Molly was talking about that, you know, those thoughts are always there. And I think that's really true. I always have to be working against those disordered thoughts and eating disorder sort of voices in my head. But it does get easier slowly but surely. So,
well, Kelly, thank you so much for sharing with us today.
Thank you. I really appreciate you guys talking about this subject.
Kelly in Riverside sharing her story. And I want to turn to you, Sue. When we were talking with Molly earlier and she was saying, don't be the food police. The dietitian is there for that. And this must be a very difficult role for you when you're working with people who have an eating disorder, with helping them try to navigate this very complicated relationship with food.
It's difficult and very rewarding at the same time. As Molly indicated, when people are in a residential or inpatient treatment, it is almost like a cocoon. There is no triggering behaviors, but then they go out in real life. And I think the importance of having that medical team follow up in real life, because they come home and they're surrounded again by all those media messages. They have family that is very scared. They're in school. Their life is busy, but they still have those thoughts. And as a way of coping, you know, my role is, how do I teach what their bodies need, the proper nutrition and food to make themselves function and work, but also challenge the food myths. You know, I want to resolve those disordered thoughts and feelings, and it needs to be a true team approach. I don't mind being the food police at all. I would far rather do it than family and friends. My role is for my clients to have a wonderful, fulfilling life. I hope I get those disordered thoughts angry and challenged, so they can see that the eating disorder does not define them, that they are just thoughts. We need to be mindful that they do come back, but how do I nourish myself adequately? And you wrap up little nuggets and send it to the therapist when something comes out of how combined they can live a great life.
We have heard from three different women who suffered from eating disorders. All three of them began these behaviors when they were teenagers. And Michelle, that is the group of people that most of us immediately think of when we think about eating disorders. But give us an idea of how much broader this picture is, because this is not a disease of just teenage girls.
Absolutely not. Both genders are impacted, all socioeconomic, all age range of individuals. There really is no one that is immune to the possible development of an eating disorder. And we are seeing more and more in our culture that individuals who are entering retirement are starting to struggle with eating disorders for the first time in their lives, that there may be someone who, you know, doesn't have any concerns with disordered eating, any eating disordered behaviors until they are entering retirement. And then again, when there's a shift in identity, a loss of control, then that is a moment when we're susceptible to reaching out and stressors.
This is something we're seeing a big increase in. Is part of that because we're so much more aware and doctors are able to diagnose this so much more often?
I do think that there is a big component to that. I feel like we're doing a better job of educating physicians across the board to start asking the question. It is a disease of silence and isolation, and if we're not asking the questions, we are not going to find out the information about those people who are struggling.
Now, a lot of people like to blame media images for eating disorders, and of course, we don't know really what all the causes. There are obviously many causes of eating disorders. But Michelle, from your perspective, where does this come from?
There's an incredible genetic link that is occurring. We've known that just from talking with families and getting family history. However, science and technology is proving that without a shadow of a doubt. The reality is that research is now using PET scans and brain imagery to look at what happens in the brain structure and the stimulation of the brain. And we're seeing differences amongst people who have typical eating behaviors and a difference in a brain of someone who is more anorexic and a difference in a brain that is more bulimic. And so we're literally seeing the genetic difference. And they're actually doing some studies right now on infants scanning brains and going to rescan them at a later date in their life to see if there's an ability to kind of predict which individuals are going to be more likely to develop eating disorders.
That's fascinating. But there is a media component to this as well, isn't there? I mean, we just saw a little while ago the big grand finale of The Biggest Loser. There's been a lot of controversy over that, where the winner of The Biggest Loser lost 155 pounds in this 12-week period and went to a size zero. She dropped from 260 pounds to 105 pounds. And, of course, that was celebrated on the program. That sounds incredibly frightening and like weight loss that is way too fast.
Absolutely. As you're talking about it, even I can feel my whole body get tense. That is just so dangerous for people to manipulate their bodies in that kind of way. In recovery, and, you know, Sue can talk more about, you know, the weight component, but what we're wanting is sustained health over time. What we're wanting are realistic lifestyles where people are eating a balanced intake and moving their bodies in joyful ways that are healthy. And when society looks at that kind of abuse, and I see that as abuse, and celebrates that, it's really indicative of our very skewed perception of what health is.
I want to go back to the phones. David is on the line in Ames. And as I mentioned earlier, we've talked to three different women who started these behaviors as teenage girls. David, you also struggled with an eating disorder.
Yeah, Charity, thanks for having me on. It was kind of long battle through high school and then college, and I just wanted to shed some light and talk about how a lot of the factors that I felt I noticed in other people. I spent time at an inpatient for many months, and also out of patient and inpatient, and then partial, and then back and stuff like that. You guys were talking about the cocoon and how it's safe and all that, and I really felt like the biggest thing, what was frustrating is you felt like you're not understood, and it is a control issue. But also for me, it was one of those things where you wish it was something else that you're dealing with. For example, I wished on a daily basis that it was like a cancer or something, mm-hmm. where it's not your fault, you know, and like, hey, you just go into treatment and like everyone can really support you and it's great.
So you felt a lot of blame from others when you were trying to get better?
Oh, definitely. You know, because it's not understood, and I've never had any other issues with addiction or anything like that. I don't smoke, I don't drink, but I can only imagine that's that sort of world where you really, you go to that place and it's known and it's safe, and even you, and it is all these things like it was body image and it was just a, you know, ton of things, but you get comfort in it, and I don't know, like I really felt like it was hard for anyone to understand, just like when you talk to someone about maybe quitting smoking, and like if you don't smoke, well, just quit. And it's not that easy. And for me, you know, you wish it was something that was a disease that was physical or symptomatic that, you know, could be removed or treated, or, right. You know, and then you'd be in recovery and you can live your life. But
and as a man dealing with this issue, was that an extra stigma for you?
Big time. Like none of my friends. I mean, it was funny because I know they were talking earlier about you can't, you know, like tell from afar or from a book if someone has dealt with an eating disorder. But with my symptoms and stuff, like all like everyone knew something was wrong. They could look at me and just, you know, like my nickname was Auschwitz. You know, I mean, it was these things that would reinforce it, but also give you validation. Like I must be doing something right. And So everyone knew something was wrong. They just, they couldn't figure it out. Like, why don't you eat? You should eat. You should have more to eat. And then being an inpatient, intensive inpatient in care, I was surrounded by a lot of women going through this problem. And so then you start comparing yourself to these girls and, well, I can't be, I don't have a problem. Like, you know, I'm not there. And yeah, it is a continual, the voice. There's a book, My Life with Ed, that I've read many times when I was in intensive, and you feel like you develop this friend who is constantly talking in the background, and you learn how to cope. And you, the biggest thing, Charity, that I think that any RD who kind of works in this field will tell you, is that you have to deal with these wave of emotions. So after you eat and you feel full, you have to let the emotions subside, and also you have to get to a healthy, you know, goal range weight. Because for me, you have to feel comfortable in your own skin. And for me, I had to put on a lot of weight to get back into a healthy range. And when you're depriving yourself of nutrition and stuff like that, your brain doesn't work, you know, healthy.
Right.
It's not in a healthy mindset. So it's really hard for you to get to that point where you can think clearly, because you're really in the grasp of an eating disorder.
Right. Well, David, thank you so much for sharing your story with us today. And we're nearly out of time. Sue, I want to turn to you. As David was saying, people said, just eat. Getting over an eating disorder and helping your body recover physically is not a simple process.
No, not at all. It is a journey. We need to learn how to trust. We each have this wonderful, it's our own little piece of the universe, which is our body. And when we are told, again, oftentimes by those inside voices, you are worthless, this body hates you, it will betray you, it's horrible. You know, part of the job is that slow teaching that, well, wait, when I begin to eat, I'm functioning better. I feel better. I have more concentration. I'm not as cold. But those voices always told me that when it happened. And so it is a journey, and you do different things week after week to come to the realization that, well, wait, those were actually very irrational thoughts I have. How do I make this rational? Well, let me look at what's happening to myself right now. And it's also really learning the role of food in the body. You know, the role of food in the body is it makes all these body processes happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, Alyssa was saying earlier that she needed to think about food as medicine. Is that an approach that you see a lot of people taking?
Yes, initially, because food is medicine. We don't have drugs that make a starving body 100%. So yes, food is medicine. And you hope to go from food is medicine, that food should be a joyful part of your life, because it helps us have these remarkable bodies that give us life and take us places.
Sue, thank you so much. Sue Clarahan is a registered dietitian who has a private practice in Iowa. And Michelle, we are out of time, but with all that we've learned about eating disorders, treatment is still so very difficult. For people, the general public, what is the one thing you want people to understand?
There is always hope. Regardless of how long you have suffered with your eating disorder, the sooner you seek treatment, the greater your chances of long-term recovery. And the Eating Disorder Coalition is here for support. It's edciowa.org.
All right, Michelle, thank you so much. Michelle Rowling is co-founder and president of the Eating Disorder Coalition of Iowa. She is also a therapist. And the Eating Disorder Coalition of Iowa is having an awareness day Saturday, February 22nd from 8 to 4 p.m. It's a free event at DMAC Southridge Center in Des Moines. Stories of survivors and also a lot of education about eating disorders as well. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nubbe.